around on RN Summer. This is Books and Arts Daily. Amanda Smith with you all this week to bring you highlights of the artists' conversations we recorded at the 2014 Melbourne International Arts Festival. This morning you get a Dublin Theatre Company and a London Chamber Orchestra. The Aurora Orchestra, they're one of the new wave of chamber orchestras who put together unorthodox concert programs. They mix musical styles and introduce other art forms into their concerts, and you can hear all about them later in this hour in Books and Arts. First up, a play by Broken Talkers. This is a theatre company based in Dublin. The play is called Have I No Mouth, written and directed by Phelim Cannon and Gary Keegan. It's the story of death in the family, in this case two deaths, Phelim's father and his little brother, both of whom were called Sean. Have I No Mouth is written specifically to be performed by three people, Phelim Cannon, his mother Anne, and a therapist, Eric Keller. Michael Cathcart is in conversation with them at the Festival Hub down by the Yarra River in Melbourne.
So the characters, or the real people who are reporting on their experience in this, are you, Phelim, and you, Anne, and then in the middle is the therapist, Eric. Now, Eric, are you the therapist that actually worked with these two, or are you a stand-in therapist?
No, I'm...
You're the therapist.
Yeah.
So everyone is who they claim to be in this play.
Yeah, there's no cloaks or daggers.
So it's not really a play. I mean, by definition, a play is where the people on stage are pretending to be other people. So it's not a play. It's a theatrical experience, isn't it?
I mean, you can. It's whatever you wanted to call it. I mean, I don't want to get too...
Yeah, I don't want to get semantic. I'm not arguing. I'm actually highlighting what an interesting construct it is that the three people we meet are actually who they say they are. Did you take any persuading, Eric?
Persuading, yeah. You know, it's a common question from other therapists, the idea of confidentiality and what happens within the therapy space. How could we honour the confidentiality piece, knowing that potentially this would be something played out on stage?
I'm going to tell you something a little bit embarrassing about myself, but since you're a therapist, I feel I can share
this
with you.
Well, we're on a couch here, so
off
you go.
Yeah, I'm on the couch, yes. I looked at your name in the program, and your name was Eric, and I hadn't at that stage appreciated you were actually the therapist.
Okay.
And I thought, Eric, with an H on the end, that's an anagram of Reich. As in Wilhelm Reich, you know, one of the uber therapists of all time. I thought, oh, that's a nice joke. An Irishman whose name is a... But that wasn't the joke. It wasn't... There was no joke. You're just Eric. Eric, the
just
actual
me.
Therapist.
Yeah.
So we come into the space and it's just a big empty theatre. You haven't dressed the theatre at all. There's no illusion that you're creating a physical world. There's a couple of knockabout tables on the stage and there's a few objects. There's a cardboard box that contains a doll. Because the first thing we're talking about is losing a baby. So how did this... I'll ask you, Anne. How did this happen? I mean, you lost a child.
I did, who was also called Sean. He would have been my youngest son. And it was through cot death. Before I brought him home from the hospital, 15 hours after he was born, a beautiful baby boy, who from the time I became pregnant had a feeling that there was something wrong. And that's what the doll represents. And the reason why the doll is there is that just after baby Sean died, which was just after Christmas, in one of the local shops, there was this beautiful doll that looked so real. And it took me all my time not to buy it. And I knew, look, you're trying to replace a baby, and this won't replace the baby. And then I realised, no, I actually needed just something to hold. And when I went back to the shop, it was gone. So they decided, Phelim and Gary, to put a doll in. And they asked our stage manager to get the most freakiest doll he could find. And he brought three. And I chose that one because that one is, to me, the most beautiful baby. Mm. May not look it to other people, but to me, it's the most beautiful baby.
Phelim, you tell us that your younger self couldn't understand how your parents could have lost a baby. Just take us to that moment.
Yeah, I remember it was. I remember my brother's death very vividly. I was six, and there's a bit in the show where we have a disagreement about a memory. As far as I can remember, I remember seeing him in the hospital, but my mother says that isn't true, so we kind of have a bit of a debate about that. But what I do remember is being in the kitchen in my grandparents' house, and my parents were about to come in, and my grandmother said, now just be easy with your mother, she's upset, and you know, don't be shouting, you need to be quiet, and just give her a hug and a kiss. And she tried to explain to me that my mother had lost the baby, and my six-year-old mind took that literally, and I just didn't understand why we weren't out looking for the baby.
Yeah. How did you lose the baby?
How did you lose the baby? Yeah, I couldn't comprehend.
Try to remember the last time you had him.
Yeah. So that was very strong, and that memory has kind of stuck with me all through my life. So.
It's tragic in the mouth of a six-year-old boy. It's funny in the mouth of Lady Bracknell, of course. Do you remember that line? To lose one parent, Mr. Worthing, may be regarded as a misfortune. Mm. To lose both looks like carelessness.
Yeah.
And what comes through in the play is that you have a sort of catechism of life rules. About halfway through, there's a scene where you test him on some life principles, and they are, well, equivalent to a sort of Catholic catechism. Can you share some of these fundamental principles of life with us?
Well, I suppose I was born into a Catholic family, not an over-religious family. It might come across on stage that we weren't, but I have a very deep belief in a loving God. And when Phelim and Pádraig, my other son, were young, I felt that they needed a foundation for life so that they would, I suppose, respect others and others' beliefs as well. The rules that are in the show were very much to keep them safe. There's one where I tell Phelim he's not to take sweets from strangers and he's not to get into a car. Because around the time that he would have been six, there was an incident near our local school where our politicians decided to come and go into the school and talk to the parents, but then decided to hand out sweets to the children. And I felt that was wrong. I also felt I had been teaching Phelim not to take sweets from strangers. And so that was one of the rules that I felt really needed to go in.
Another of the rules that you internalise, Phelim, early is the safe cross code. Mm. Now, I don't think we have the safe cross code in Australia. I mean, we teach children about looking to the left, looking to the right, looking to the left again. That's the way we do it. But there's a little Irish children has taught a song.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you share the song with us?
Yeah, absolutely. Sonny, you might help me here, just if I get this wrong. So do you want to do it, Anne? So you give either the numbers.
Oh.
One, remember one.
Remember one.
Look for a safe place.
Two.
Don't hurry, stop and wait.
Three.
Look all around and listen before you cross the road, remember.
Four.
Let all the traffic pass you.
Five.
Then walking straight across you.
Six.
Keep watching. That's the safe cross code. But what's very important is that you don't sing that as you're crossing the road. It's a bit distracting.
At least you would be taken in the moment of faith.
That's true, yeah.
Another one of Mum's insights into you, Phelim, is that you bottle up your fears. She says to you, you bottle up your fears. And she asks you, what are you afraid of? And what do you say?
Freddy Krueger.
Yes.
Which I am.
Freddy Krueger, who's, of course, the scary guy on Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stuff, everything in the show comes from a very real place, so the script would have been devised in a workshop environment and with Eric, and that opening scene is a reenactment of a therapy session, and it's pretty much what I said. I mean, the reason why I said Freddy Krueger is that I don't really want to talk about the real things. It's another kind of a shield that I would have put up. So it was difficult for Eric, because I remember the first sessions with Eric, we didn't speak, he didn't say anything, I didn't say anything, and it was pretty boring. It took a while for me to kind of...
It took you a while to trust the process.
Yeah.
To open up and allow
whatever
it was that needed to be said to come out.
Because I I've never done therapy before, but when I was in college in Dublin, I put my arm through a glass window in an act of violence, which is, I don't feel too good about. And I was told by the college I had to go to counselling or I wouldn't graduate. So I went to one of these counselling sessions with a counsellor, and he said, oh, you're studying drama. I was like, yeah. He goes, you're just probably acting out. So I said, okay, so if I punch you now, does that mean I'm only acting out? So I just didn't really trust that, this thing about sitting down and speaking to somebody. And my mother had gone through the therapy sessions after my dad died over that 10-year period and really helped her. So, being an Irish man, we don't like talking about our emotions unless we're drunk. So it just took a while for me to get into that headspace. And also to take the sessions as real as possible. Obviously, I knew they were going to be ending up in the show on some level, but it was important for me to, that simulation was as real as possible. So, I really went into these sessions with Eric not thinking, oh, wouldn't that be a great bit in the show to talk about that? It was genuinely to do these sessions with Eric, and then we'd listen back to the recordings, Gary and I, Gary's the other company member, and we'd kind of extract the bits that we liked from the sessions, and then we'd bring them into the workshop with Anne and Eric, and we'd kind of tease out.
As Phelan's talking, Eric, I realise that professionally, your primary consideration presumably was it good for these two? Mm-hmm. They'd been through a process with you, a process of therapy. Mm-hmm. Now here was Phelan saying, let's put this on the stage. Yeah. What was your initial response?
Well, my initial response was to think about it. Concern. I think the first conversation I had with Gary was... I was really questioning, what's Phelan doing here?
Just to explain, Gary Keegan is Phelan's partner in the theatre company,
yeah.
And he directed the show, I think, is that right?
Co-directed, yeah.
Yeah.
Co-directed, okay.
So, because I was saying, this, what's the potential of this? Yeah, I was concerned. I didn't know, are these people in crisis? Where are they with their grieving? What's my responsibility here with that? So... we really did spend a lot of time talking about this. What are the parameters? What's the safe area and what's not? And once we set out the parameters and really... because my first response to Phelan was, well, if you really want to do this, you should really experience the therapeutic side of healing. You can't really go out there on stage and say this is what this is if you haven't experienced it, So we set it up that they were proper sessions, times, regular slots. We talked about the confidentiality and what that would mean here, because it kind of turns everything on its head. From my own perspective, I wondered, what would other therapists think? Do they think I'm breaking some code?
Clearly.
And I've had different reactions, and I've had to hold that. But the one thing I can say is that everything you see on the stage comes from a really honest and authentic place. There's different therapies used and demonstrated within the show that I wouldn't necessarily... like the anger balloon thing, that's more for children.
Well, let's
talk
about the anger balloon thing.
Yeah.
So the audience, as they come in, are each member is given a balloon, and you don't know why you're getting a balloon. Mm. And then... I don't know, about two-thirds of the way through the show, you come forward and the lights come up on the audience and you say, now each of you has a balloon, and you invite them. Well, tell us what you do. You invite them to do what?
It's a very simple method of demonstrating that feelings are something that don't necessarily have to control you, that you can kind of take them and look at them.
So you say to everyone, blow up your balloon?
Yeah, blow up the balloon.
So we all sit there going...
yeah.
Everybody in the audience is blowing up a big-coloured balloon. It looks fantastic. And then you say, now, instead of just popping it and going bang, squeeze the entrance of the balloon, whatever that bit where you blow into, and it goes...
yeah. And it's again, it's a way of looking at something that is potentially difficult and testing your own feelings around that difficult feeling.
En masse, so, though, it just sounds distressing. It sounds like a bunch of cats that haven't been fed for a
week. And again, you have lots of different reactions, and that's one of the things I really like about Broken Talkers, which are Gary and Phelim, is how they invite the audience to experience something that they didn't expect.
Yeah.
And the anger balloon is a demonstration of that. So you're being asked to come in contact with your anger, and yet at the same time you're doing it, and you don't even realize that you're kind of doing it in a safe way. And some people like it, some people don't. We've had different reactions. In that piece around the balloon, of course, I say, if you feel comfortable with balloons, because there's many who aren't. I think I saw one person in the audience last night cover her ears and look terrified. You know, there's some kind of fear around it.
Now, in our conversation, we've talked about the death of this brother, of this little boy. There's also the death of your father. And he's the person against whom you vent the most rage, actually, it seems to me. There's an astonishing sequence where up on the back of the theatre you show a series of photographs that your father had taken of the family. I don't know how many there are. There might be a dozen, there might be 20, but endless shots, Christmas shots, party shots, all sorts of things. And you stand there in this vacant space that your father left on the left-hand side of every photograph. It's astonishing that the family are all over on one side of the shot, and on the other side there is a big empty space. And what do you say again and again to your father?
I just ask him, why do you leave all the space to the left? Why is the space there? Well, I don't know the answer to that question, but a friend of mine, my oldest friend, and he's actually in one of those photographs, he came to see the show when we did it in Dublin. And it was really nice to hear. I don't know why my dad did that, but my best friend's rationale was he was leaving a space there for your brother.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought too.
No, I never actually thought of that. So,
right, it's obvious, isn't it, Eric? It's a room for the missing brother. He's not gone.
For me, the significance is more about the questions that can never be answered once somebody passes. That's what you're left with, and how you deal with that space. For Phelim, it's even changed. When we first did the show, Phelim would get really angry. Remember, you were nearly punching the screen because he would, the frustration of that unanswered question and the knowledge, that concrete knowledge that I will never know.
See, I thought that what you're angry about was that your father was paying more attention to an absent brother and less attention to you, that he couldn't put you in the center of the picture.
No. That's okay. That's good. That's your opinion, but that's not how I feel.
Oh, I'm just.
No. It's okay.
No, but
the piece is open up to interpretation. That's absolutely fine. It is what it is. No. I'm just. And I suppose to be clear for the people who haven't seen the show, for the people who have seen the show. Yes, I'm quite angry. I'm angry at the situation. I'm not angry at my dad. You know, myself.
You're angry at the situation that resulted in his death.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was taken away. The anger comes from the frustration of your hero being taken away, and you know you do kind of blame them because he's your dad. You know, I'm still his son. I kind of blame them for leaving us. He obviously didn't want to go.
We should make it clear, this is not an anger at the cosmos. This is a very directed anger because your father got sick. Mm. He received a treatment which you say is inappropriate, and a treatment which you say killed him.
If he'd been fully diagnosed, we wouldn't be sitting here today. Phelim would have been here with a different piece, and his dad would have been here to see it.
Are you angry too?
I am very angry at how the legal and medical profession treat everybody. The particular consultant was arrogant. He didn't listen. He knew best. He didn't take on board that we were telling him that there were other symptoms. They didn't seem to matter to him. And he was at the top of his profession. He was the person. And I couldn't. And I'm angry that I couldn't save my husband.
And is your involvement in this play your way of getting a message to the rest of the world that he wouldn't hear?
Yes. My message is, no matter what, if you come up against the medical profession or the legal profession, because I had to fight with the coroner, and you have an instinct that something's not right, please go with that instinct and push and shout and take your own power. And you need to do that, because if not, this will happen again.
Last night I saw the show, and after the show was over, I spoke to some members of the audience and asked them what they made of it.
I mean, it was dark, it was sad, but I really enjoyed it.
Did you ever feel as though you were intruding on somebody's very private story?
Yeah, I did actually, especially since we were front row as well. But I think that's the whole point of it.
Oh, intensely emotive. It was beautiful.
What do you know now that you didn't know when you came into this theatre a couple of hours ago?
How much I love my parents.
That same thought. I just really want to talk to my dad now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people will reflect in a broad way on their relationship with their fathers and their sons. And it was beautiful to see someone who's not used to being on stage in his mum. It was really lovely to spend some time, with a mum, I guess.
What do you know now that you didn't know 2 hours ago?
I know that it will be incredibly difficult to see my father die. And I guess I wouldn't have thought about anger as an emotion, as part of grief.
Is this the sort of thing you expect to see when you go to the theatre?
This is what I hope to see and sometimes expect to see at the Melbourne Festival. So, yeah, I was surprised and pleased.
Fathom, is there anything there that surprises you?
No. That tends to be the reaction that we get. What I've noticed over the last couple of years doing the piece is that post-show, when we go out into the foyer or whatever, people tend to gravitate towards my mother and they want to talk to her. And we were always there to speak to people. And just doing that piece, we're very kind of emotionally fragile. So that comes out with us out of that room into the next room. And it's always good to speak to people. It's always good to talk to people because so many people have gone through similar events in their life. And I think it helps them sometimes that they see a family up there who are tackling those emotions kind of head on. So I think these are things I didn't expect would have happened when I made the show. It's a result of the piece being finished.
Are you ever troubled that the play itself may be locking you into a particular emotional moment in your life? Because I guess some people must be saying to you, there will come a moment when you need to move on.
Well, no, because I'm going to always feel this way about my dad's death. So that's never going to change. I mean, doing the piece has been a real help, actually, if anything, you know. It's made myself and my mother, you know, the fact that we're touring the world and we're here in Melbourne, it's amazing, and we're getting to see great places, meet great people. It's all positive. It's all good. So, no, I hope this goes on. I hope I'm, like, in my 70s doing this show, like, and you're 101, and, you know, we're still doing it. I don't know if I'll be able to throw Eric around as much then, but when I look into Eric's eyes at some points in the show, they do look like my dad's eyes. I mean, again, like they do, and sometimes I see my father on stage, and that's a bit difficult, but it's also nice. It's nice to see him again. So it's all very positive.
Does that appeal to you, Anne, to go on doing this show until you're a very old lady? Or I put that up, that term to you again. Is there a moment when you want to feel that you can move on?
I suppose for me doing the show, I realise that each night at different stages, a memory comes back. And it's possibly one that I haven't dealt with. So I then go on and deal with that. I made the decision last year that the day that I'm not nervous going on, not terrified going on, is the day that I give up. But as long as people ask and want to hear the story, I will continue to tell it. Because it has been a healing for me. It has been I have seen a healing in Phelan, and I've seen a healing in my younger son, Porrick. And I believe, deep down, that each night we go on, Sean comes on stage in spirit, and then he goes away again. But he's with us, and I know that he's very proud of Phelan. And that's my deep belief in an afterlife. I know he's around, and he's around mostly when we're on stage, telling his story as well.
It's difficult and stuff, but we're all right. Mm. We're staying in a lovely hotel here in Melbourne. You know, we go back and we have a drink after the show. We're in good form. You know, we're okay.
And would you please thank Anne and Phelan Cannon and Eric Keller? It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Michael Cathcart, with the cast of Have I No Mouth, performed at the 2014 Melbourne Festival and about to be performed again in Australia at the Sydney Festival from the 15th to the 18th of January. You're listening to Books and Arts Daily here on RN Summer with Amanda Smith.